are listening to KPTZ 91.9 FM in Port Townsend, and this is Book Lovers Cafe. Book Lovers Cafe is a program of reviews and interviews with a local perspective. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and I'm speaking here today at the KPTZ studio, not on the phone as usual, with our guest, Dar Jamail. Now, Dar has traveled a lot around the world. He is an award-winning journalist and an author who currently works as a full-time staff reporter for the news website truthout.org. And I've been spending a lot of time on truthout.org lately, and I'm very impressed. He began his career by covering the U.S. invasion and occupation of Iraq extensively as an unembedded journalist. I want to make that point. And then he shifted into environmental journalism, where he now focuses primarily on human-caused planetary climate disruption, the issue of our time. Welcome, Dar. Thank you so much for being here.
Thanks. Good to be with you.
Well, I heard you now reside in Port Townsend, which we are very fortunate about. Can you tell us a little bit about your personal journey?
Well, in a nutshell, I became politicized, I would say, a little bit later than life. I wasn't raised with a strong political bent, although I was raised in a conservative household down in South Texas, nearby Houston. And I started traveling a lot after college and basically became exposed to a lot more of the world. And I didn't really, though, get extremely politicized until I moved up to Alaska. I basically got a college degree in speech communications, but wasn't really on any kind of career path and wasn't really interested in kind of jumping into the machine and getting, you know, doing the usual get a job, take on debt, start working for the man kind of thing. And so I just was always, for some unknown reason, given I was born and raised in Houston, Texas, was always really attracted to the mountains. And so I, in 1996, moved up to Alaska, wanted to really get into general mountaineering with the aim of climbing Denali, Mount McKinley. And I started working for a man up there named Dwayne French as his personal assistant. He was the director of the State of Alaska Division of Vocational Rehabilitation. He basically helped other people with disabilities get and keep jobs and was quadriplegic himself. And so he hired me on as his personal assistant and with the agreement that I would have time off in the summer to go do my climb.
So did you take him into the Chugach?
Well, no. He had a pretty significant disability. Oh, so okay. I basically helped him do his job. You know, I was kind of his arms and legs, helping him get around each day and then traveling with him extensively. But it was through working with him I started to become politicized, because we early on he asked me, well, what are your politics? Because he's a hardcore Democrat, blue blood political appointee. And I said, well, I don't know. I guess I'm a Republican. And he got pretty upset by this statement. And he said, you guess you're a Republican. Well, what are their policies that you like? And what are the Democratic policies that you oppose? Or why aren't you an anarchist or a green or a libertarian or independent? And I couldn't answer any of his questions because I was completely ignorant. And I said, well, whatever, man, whatever they do doesn't affect us anyway. And he said, oh, you really think so? He said, so you're my weekday personal assistant. I have a separate weekend personal assistant that I get funding from the state to have. Right now, the state is possibly going to pass a bill that would cut that funding for my weekend personal assistant. So I want you to run a little experiment for me. You're going to go home this weekend. You're going to get in bed Friday night. You're going to stay in bed until Monday morning, because that's what I would have to do. Somewhere around the middle of the day, Saturday, you will be laying in your own urine and feces. And then by that night, you'll run out of water to drink. And you're going to stay that way from Saturday night until Monday morning. And I want you to call me Monday morning and tell me that what the government does doesn't impact us. And so that basically began my political education. I said, okay, I'm listening. And I worked for him off and on for the next 8 years, and we became extremely close, and I got politicized, and You know, the more I learned, the kind of more radical of perspective I got. Radical, I use the word literally, meaning root, getting down to the truth of the reality of the situation. And then just started to really watch foreign policy real closely. And so by the time, fast forward to 2003, by the time the Iraq War broke out.
Were you still in Alaska at that point?
I was.
Because I thought your story was going to have something to do with, first of all, how important the military is in Alaska. And the defense bases, the Navy, the Army, the Air Force are all there and very critical to the economy, as well as the oil is very critical to the economy in Alaska. So this was a new story for me. So the Iraq War started. And then what?
And I was completely enraged and flabbergasted by the so-called media, mainstream media, so-called coverage of it, you know, basically the selling of a war, the propaganda just off the charts is clear to anyone.
I have to interrupt again, because to me at that point, I was in Serbia, I wasn't in Alaska, but I never thought that after Vietnam that it would happen again. And it just did. And I just could not believe that the same people that had gone through the Vietnam War were ready to go into Iraq. But that the difference was oil, right?
Well, absolutely. Oil and geostrategic positioning of the U.S. military right smack in the middle of the Middle East. And, you know, it was, you know, you bring up Vietnam and, you know, the U.S. government learned a lot of important lessons from their perspective from Vietnam. And one of them was, we need to control information. We need to control the meme. We need to control the story. And so you've always been able to embed with the U.S. military, but they took that idea and basically put it on steroids. And the first trial run of it was the first Gulf War in 1990. And then that program was augmented in a very big way and applied to the 2003 invasion to where, as a means of information control, the Pentagon developed the embed program. And that's what I think a lot of people don't know. And this is well documented, that the embed program is set up by the Pentagon specifically as a means of information control. Mm-hmm. And so it worked extremely effectively. So that's why during the invasion, you just saw people going in with the troops, and that was the only perspective you got. So you didn't see bodies. You didn't see the catastrophic effects on the Iraqi people, or even the catastrophic effects later on U.S. soldiers themselves. Mm-hmm. And so those were the parts of the story that I decided, you know, I was so angry. I did a crazy thing, like buy a laptop and a camera and get a plane ticket and go to the Middle East and find my way into Baghdad and just start reporting. And so that's what I did.
And so after that experience, you've written three books. I do want to mention these books now. First, The Will to Resist, Soldiers Who Refuse to Fight in Iraq and Afghanistan. Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from the Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, and The Mass Destruction of Iraq, The Disintegration of a Nation, Why Is It Happening, and Who Is Responsible? These three books, written by Dar Jamil, are to be found within our collection at the Port Townsend Library, if you're interested in reading them there. And, of course, they're available for purchase. So tell us about the first book that you wrote.
Well, the first book was actually Beyond the Green Zone, and it was specifically about my direct personal experience reporting from Iraq. And so it kind of takes the reader on the journey about, you know, how I got involved, how I got into Iraq, and then focuses really heavily on the stories that I came across. Because, you know, the first time I went into Iraq was November 2003, so it was about 7 months after Baghdad fell, after the invasion. And I wasn't on the streets 48 hours when I was hearing stories of torture in most U.S. detention facilities. People were enraged. The infrastructure was shattered, and all this promises of rehabilitation, reconstruction of the infrastructure were bogus. And there was a violent resistance that was already happening and growing on a daily basis against the occupation. And that's what I saw, and that's what I started writing about. And I happened to be there.
Not a popular story in the U.S. press.
No. I was a few years ahead of the game, basically because it took that long for the rest of the media to decide to start reporting on it, as governed by public opinion back home. And so, yeah, what I was writing about, at least on people, for people who had opposed the war to begin with, was very, very popular. And I started writing for a lot of left-leaning outlets and doing some reporting for Democracy Now. And it was getting out in a pretty big way that way. But then conversely, of course, no mainstream media would touch me with a 10-foot pole. And so most of my publishing was done in overseas outlets, European outlets, or alternative outlets here in the States.
And then you wrote a book about soldiers who refused to fight. And were they easy to find, hard to find? How could they tell their stories?
It was interesting how that book came to be. I was actually on book tour for the book we were just discussing, and there were more and more vets that started showing up to my talks. And I was giving a lot of talks all around the country. And, you know, now we're talking about 2009, 2010, around that time zone of when this book came out. But prior to that, you know, already public opinion about the occupation had turned pretty dramatically in this country. And so when I was actually on the tour for the first book in 2007, 2008, I started meeting vets coming up and saying, yeah, you know, what you're talking about, the absolute catastrophe that this war has brought to the Iraqi people, that's exactly what I saw. And in fact, I was opposed to it. And in fact, I ended up going AWOL. Or in fact, you know, some of the things that we started to do. I met a guy actually out of one of the main bases here in Washington State who said, yeah, we used to do what we called search and avoid missions, where we would go out on patrol and we would park our Humvees somewhere and where we wouldn't be attacked. And one of our guys had figured out how to basically move our patrol around on the computer screen so that when they tracked it back at the base, it looked like we were on patrol, but we were actually sitting still drinking tea with Iraqis or playing soccer with kids or that kind of thing, that we didn't want any part of this. And we tried to find ways to just not engage and just get through the time that we were over there and get home and then not have to go back. And so stories like that started basically coming to me. And then I realized, wow, this is widespread enough over a large period of time, coming from all different parts of the country where I was running into these folks, men and women alike. And so I decided, wow, there's enough material here. So I went ahead and wrote a book about it.
Mm-hmm. So maybe I'm putting you on the spot here, but Iraq today and also Afghanistan. We still have troops in Afghanistan. The withdrawal, I don't think, is going to start happening until in end of 2016, if it happens then. What would you like to see the U.S. do at this point? It's still Sunni versus Shia, but there's also the Islamic State. And, you know,
what people need to understand about Iraq today is that Iraq looks exactly the way it looks today, precisely and directly because of the U.S. occupation. And the U.S. went in, and I wrote about this extensively in articles as well as my first book, and use the classic policy of divide and conquer. So there was no Sunni versus Shia in Iraq before the occupation. I mean, you could go in there and talk to any Iraqi, and they would say, yeah, I didn't even know if my neighbor was Sunni or Shia. It'd be the equivalent of walking down the street here and saying, hey, what are you, a Christian? Are you a Baptist? Are you a Methodist? Are you Catholic? It's like, you just don't do that. Well, it's the same thing over there. But the U.S. came in and basically removed Saddam Hussein's regime, which was primarily Sunni, and replaced it with a Shia regime, and at the same time using death squads on the ground. And I go into the specifics of this in the book, basically started actively working to turn Sunni versus Shia and turn the Iraqis into fighting against each other, so that, because they were unifying and fighting against the U.S. occupation, and the U.S. was losing that war. And so you started to see these policies come into effect in 2005, 2006, and then really in 2007. And then that, you know, the Sunnis being completely marginalized and then staying that way and being hammered by basically a Shia-dominated government backed by the U.S. And then so enter ISIS, enter this radical group that also came out of direct U.S. support of the so-called moderate rebels in Syria. Mm-hmm. And then these folks start coming down into Iraq, starting in the takeover of Iraq's third largest city, Mosul, in the north. And then they roll into these Sunni cities in western Iraq, and then even starting to show up now in parts of Baghdad, Sunni-dominated areas of Baghdad, offering protection, basically. Say, hey, are you tired of these Shia militias coming in and carrying out violence in your neighborhood? Well, we're going to take over now. We're going to protect you. And so So that's some of the basics on the ground as to why Iraq looks the way it does today and why any solution to the situation in Iraq today, the U.S. cannot have any part in it whatsoever. So literally people say, well, what can we do? What can we do? Well, the U.S. needs to get completely uninvolved from the country. But I think, unfortunately, that's going to be I don't know if we'll probably see that in our lifetimes unless this empire completely collapses, because the bottom line is there's remains vast swaths of oil under the ground in Iraq. And so it's hard pressed to see the U.S. not being involved there in some way.
All right. Not ignoring this problem, but turning closer to home. Recently, you've been writing about our Navy's plan for war games on the Olympic Peninsula, the trainings. And I think a lot of people are still uninformed about exactly what's going on. So can you enlighten us about the current situation?
Yeah, I think most people in this community are at least aware of the basics of, mm-hmm. of what's happening, what they want to do. It would start in September. But I think a lot of the misinformation has come from the fact that Washington State, a little ways back, wrote a letter to the Navy, and this got some local media attention, where they basically said, look, we're not going to participate in your war games, which basically meant that the Navy, instead of being able to use 15 mobile ground emitters out on the Western Olympic Peninsula, could only use 13, because the Washington State move made a few forest roads inaccessible to the mm-hmm. Navy. And so it hasn't stopped. It's not been stopped. Everything is still on course for it to happen. And I think people are also aware of what that means as far as jet traffic, jet noise, and biological impacts, both from us here, from the jet noise, as well as wildlife across the peninsula, specifically the Western Olympic Peninsula. And so I think people need to understand that the heat needs to continue to be applied to local, state, and federal government officials, and that includes everyone in those categories that, mm-hmm. that you can think of, that basically hell needs to be raised, because the Navy is in the process of a massive domestic military expansion, and it's all for future war gaming against Russia and China and access to the Arctic resources, because the Navy conducted its own study, and even their estimations see the Arctic becoming ice-free in the summer starting next year. 2016 is what their survey found. And so, by way of example, I just last night at the time we're doing this interview, I just got back from Alaska. I was up there working on another Navy story where they have plans starting in mid-June, as in 6 weeks from now, starting a northern edge exercise right in the middle of the Gulf of Alaska, where they're going to drop over 300,000 pounds of live ordnance, meaning bombs, missiles, torpedoes, active and passive sonar, right in the middle of the critical salmon habitat for all five Alaska wild-caught salmon species, whales, dolphins, other marine mammals, and other hundreds of other kinds of fish. And the Navy, same thing they did here. They've slipped it by. They had their little dog and pony show public meetings, but then at the last minute, somebody became aware. And so it came to my awareness, and I was able to get up there and start, and I'm working on a story now about that basically there's all hell being raised up in Alaska. Tribes are involved. Tribes are now in the process of submitting government-to-government consultations with the U.S. government, because they're sovereign countries, so they have to be treated as another country with a grievance.
So is this in Prince William Sound off the Kodiak? Where exactly is this live ordnance being dropped in?
It's, if you look at the Gulf of Alaska, it's basically, they have, it's about 4,000 square mile rectangle, and it's off the coast of Kodiak, but it's off the coast of Kodiak and off the coast of Cordova.
So small fishermen, large.
The entire commercial fishing industry in Alaska is now under threat.
Right,
that's what I see. And they're doing it right in the middle of salmon fishing season. Mm-hmm. So it's kind of another iteration of what we're seeing here. Look, we've done this environmental impact statement. This is what the Navy says. We found no significant impacts, despite the fact that we also admit that, yes, endangered species are going to be impacted. Yes, there's this minor problem of jet noise. Yes, there's going to be live ordnance use. So the bottom line is, this is a huge story. It's happening all across the country. We're seeing it here in Port Townsend firsthand, and other people are seeing it now as it starts rolling into their front and backyards. But this is something that's not going to just go away, that it's going to take basically massive, constant, popular uprising against the government and applying pressure in the right places.
Right. Once again, we are not isolated here on the Olympic Peninsula from everything that's going on. Whitby is right. We can see Whitby from here. We can see Indian Island. In fact, we can, you know, row our little boats right over there. Mm-hmm. And so this is an issue for us. This is something that we can really stand up for.
Well, it is very much so. And I think, you know, there's the counter argument to this is, well, the military has to train and all this. And yeah, fair enough, they do. But they already have millions of acres across the country in all different kinds of settings where they can do their testing and training. So the question is, why expand into national forests? Why expand deeper into areas that are nearby population centers? It just doesn't really make logical sense. I think a compromise can be found that doesn't jeopardize human health, our peace, and certainly not wildlife, and certainly not large economies like the commercial fishing industry either here or up in Alaska. So certainly there are better solutions out there. But instead, so far, what I've been seeing is a pretty bellicose response from the Navy.
Right. I also want to talk about another issue here, and that is water. It's been in the news. We tend to think that we are completely immune from any water problems here, but we are not. And you've also written about the epic drought in California, and also the state of Washington is threatened by drought. And so can you speak to that issue?
Yeah, it's a huge issue. And I think probably a lot of folks listening are aware of the fact that, you know, the Olympics had 8% of their snowpack this year. That's a big deal. Mm-hmm. And that they started planning for the upcoming drought well over a month ago. And so, yeah, it doesn't feel like it, especially, you know, it's a beautiful day and everything's green and it's spring and there appears to be plenty of water. But, yeah, the fact is that the situation in California is not going to go away. And I use the best sources I can find in my climate reporting, usually leaning extremely heavily on NASA scientists. And if you look at the situation in California, and this is not my opinion, I'm just the messenger here. And if we look at the best science generated by this country, i.e. NASA and studies that are being published in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences and Nature Magazine and prestigious outlets like this, the situation in California, this is the very beginning of a mega drought that is expected to last at least 30 years. So where are those people going to go? They're not going to be able to stay there. And we're already seeing a migration up to Seattle. You don't usually hear it referred to as a climate change instigated migration, but that's certainly a big factor in it. And then us over here with our proximity to Seattle, we will see more of those people coming over here. And in fact, my wife and I intentionally moved up here about a year ago, looking at the climate change modeling for the country and looking at what's happening basically across most of the rest of the country in the future, fast forward 30, 40 years from now. And if you look at the climate modeling being produced by NASA, the far northwest and the far northeast are going to be the least impacted places. We're still going to be heavily impacted as we're mm-hmm. seeing right now, mm-hmm. but far less than places like California or the southwest or even the Midwest, for that matter. So I think this is a situation that people need to pay attention to and just understand that we live in a very, very dynamic situation now, one that we've never been in as a species. We are in the midst of abrupt climate change, and it is going to affect us. And I think, you know, one of the most obvious ways we're going to see that is, I think at some point in the not-so-distant future, there will be a lot more people looking to move up here.
This is KPTZ Radio 91.9, and I'm the host of Book Lovers Cafe, Chris Wilson. And today we're talking about journalist and activist and author Dar Jamail. Dar, what do you want us to know? Where do we go from here? We do want to keep being informed, but can you give us some action?
I think, you know, I've never really felt it my place to try to even suggest to other people what to do, although I used to try. And I don't consider myself an activist anymore at all. And I think, you know, a good friend of mine, a couple of people whose work I respect and has had a big influence on my own. One, Joanna Macy, and down in Berkeley, and another, an author named Derek Jensen, who also lives down in Northern California. And both of them at different times have said, both to me directly as well as in public talk, said, the most important thing to do now is, I think, to go out into nature, go out in the places that you really, really love and that really feed your soul, and just pay attention and listen to what those places are telling you. If it's the mountains, if it's the rivers, if it's the ocean, if it's the forest. But if you really tune in, I think you'll pick up on what they're telling you, and it's pretty easy to see what needs to be done. And for me, it's the mountains. That's my favorite place to go. And I go there almost every weekend. And when I see what's happening up in there as far as glacier retreat, lack of water, things like this, it's pretty clear that this area wants and needs to be protected. And so I think that then informs how I live my life and what I decide to do with my time and what I try to figure out I can do to make a difference. And I think ideally, you know, if I were the benevolent dictator of the universe, I would ask other people to do similarly.
Thank you very much for joining us today. We've been listening to Book Lovers Cafe, and our guest today is Dar Jamail. Join us next time to talk more about books and authors. I'm your host, Chris Wilson, and I'd like to thank the volunteers in Port Townsend for making KPTZ possible, especially Nora Petridge, our engineer and station manager, and Larry Stein. Join us next time for more discussion about books and ideas. Thank you.